made USAA insurance for veterans like James. When he found out how much USAA was helping members save, he said,
"It's time to switch.
We'll help you find the right coverage at the right price. USAA. What you're made of, we're made for. Restrictions apply."
This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Ping.fm, and UpSnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Madeira Show, where he will discuss testosterone optimization and full body health for the high-performance modern man. Now, here's your host, Dr. Madeira.
Hello, everyone. It's Dr. Madeira back on the Dr. Madeira Show, and today I'm very excited to have Dr. Ralph Esposito here on the show. How's it going, Ralph?
Hey, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've been waiting over a year to do this, so thanks for your time. And you are an expert in men's health. Dr. Ralph Esposito is a naturopathic physician and licensed acupuncturist specializing in integrative urology, endocrinology, and men's health. Ralph practices in New York City, acting as medical consultant and research analyst, and he also is adjunct professor at New York University. So, how are things going in the men's health world? What are some of the things that you've been seeing recently that have been kind of popping up around men's health for you with patients? Anything interesting that has come up recently that you feel like the audience should know about?
Yeah, I feel like it's the same story over and over again, just the questions are so much more unique. And, it really comes down to a lot of men concerned about their hormonal health. Am I optimizing my male hormones? And then it first comes out with questions like, how do I improve my testosterone? And then it trickles into other questions like, how do I improve my body composition? How do I improve my sex life? How do I improve my muscle recovery? And then it all is just coming down to, it's the same question, just everybody's asking in a different manner. I think that's probably one of the most redundant things that go on, but it's nonetheless always fun.
Excellent. Yeah, it does seem like it. I like what you said there about it being kind of the same question from like a different point of view. So, I mean, us men, we tend to procrastinate, minimize our health, in generally speaking, for the mass population of men. And, you know, we're typically sicker than our female counterparts and die younger, more cardiovascular disease, et cetera, et cetera. So how do us men stay healthy when we are so sick? And how do we kind of like, how are you seeing with patients that you're able to kind of help them pull that mask off or help their family members come in and see a doctor like yourself?
Yeah. So if the question is, how do we get men to see more doctors? How do we get them to be more conscious of their health? I think there's a few different avenues now. Before, it used to be just their partner, right? It was, you know, have their girlfriend or their boyfriend or their wife or their fiance, whoever it is, to bring them in. Sometimes that could trickle down to, you know, their sister or their mother or daughter sometimes, who can really pull them in and get them to go see the doctor. The Mayo Clinic, I believe, did a study, or no, I'm sorry, it was Cleveland Clinic, they did a study, and I think it was approximately 40% of men will talk about a medical concern, whether it's, you know, sexually or non-sexually related, hormonal related or not. It's just, they don't want to talk about it with a doctor. So that's one avenue. As we can, you know, I don't know how many of your listeners are women, but even if they don't have a man in their life, they certainly have the capacity to influence other men in their life, because for some reason men tend to listen to the women in their lives. It's, you know, my father would always say, you know, just listen to your mother, you know, listen to your mom. She knows what's best. I still do. So, but that's one avenue that we think we can help men improve their health span. The other aspect I think now is getting a lot more attention is improving health span or improving men's health by social media. And I actually don't like that route. The reason why is, you know, something came out recently, I think it was today actually, I posted about it, how, you know, like the major questions of 2019 were, you know, what is keto? How do I lower my blood pressure? How do I lose weight? How do I cut back my calories, right? Or how many calories are in X? So that tells me that a lot of men are now researching it and looking into it. Now that could be women as well. But women are more open to talking to their practitioner about it. Men are less so. But men flock to forums and they flock to social media to try to get those answers. So I think that is one aspect that I think people with a social media influence, they now take on a larger responsibility, because you have to speak to a mass of men who are listening to you as if what you're saying is true. Unfortunately, a lot of it is untrue or misleading, and oftentimes leads people to buy a product. So I think the guide to getting men healthier is doing things like what we're doing, getting on podcasts, getting on social media, writing, telling people like these are the facts, and then prefacing it all with, and I'll preface my comment here today with, you shouldn't believe a damn thing that I say right now. You should check me, fact check me, double fact check me, make sure what I'm saying is correct. And then if it doesn't seem a lot in line with what you're seeing, then try to figure out where the message become miscommunicated. And you should do that with every single individual that you see or anything that you read, because that allows men to you know, see the right information and pushes them to go see the doctor. So I think that those are the two major avenues that I think we could have the most pull.
I appreciate you saying that. What I run into a lot is exactly what you're saying, is the biohacker crowd coming into my clinic in Seattle, in when I'm in Whitefish, Montana as well. And they've done some research and they think they know some things, and they know some things and they don't know some things. And it's, you know, it's like the ignorance that kills us, right? And everything has, you know, like an LD50 pretty much, or like a lethal, yeah, lethal dose, right? So from a pharmacy point of view, you know, you could overdose on, you know, you can overdose on vitamin D, you can overdose on fish oils, and then if you have a procedure, you can bleed out and die. So like these things are all medicine. And I think what happens is the general public doesn't always understand the risk there. And, you know, we're already, you know, third leading cause of death is medications, rightly prescribed procedures. So we're already kind of there with pharmaceuticals. Like, let's not add insult to injury and have people like overdosing on natural things too, as an example. So, you know, there are some big influencers in the men's health industry, or testosterone industry and the health industry, and they're not physicians. So they haven't seen a patient. They haven't sat one-on-one with hundreds or thousands of patients over years and said, like, figured out what has worked in the trenches as well as kept up on the research like you do. So that's why I've been so excited to have you on the show. Along those lines, you know, stress is a huge, huge issue for all of us, and especially men who, we tend, as I said, to minimize things. So until things are really bad and the wheels have already fallen off the bus and then we're in the ER with a heart attack, or we've already had one heart attack and we're there again, and then the family is kind of screaming at them to say, please do something about your health. You know, I got into medicine from the emergency medicine side. I was an EMT, and I remember there's a 30-something-year-old man, maybe late 30s, had an acute MI, and he waited 4 days to come to the ER, and he thought he had pulled a chest muscle, like a pec muscle, lifting a three-wheeler. This is northern New Hampshire, so it's more rural for the listeners. And the nurse asked him, like, what the hell? Like, why didn't you come sooner? And he's like, oh, I just thought I pulled a muscle, you know? And his diet that he reported was like pizza and beer and chips and all that junk food. And, you know, this is the kind of like common masculine bravado where men it's kind of like cool or masculine to be, you know, unhealthy, drinking lots, you know, not sleeping, bragging about getting 5 hours of sleep or less and keep going. Or at least that's the way it used to be. I think it's changing more in maybe some communities for sure. But in generally speaking, so, you know, how do we kind of get through that curtain and then help men come in and talk to us about, okay, like how stressed are you really? Like, let's talk about this. You're working 56 hours a week. You know, you don't have time to exercise. Like, let's get real. How are you helping men take off that mask in visits 1, 2, and 3?
Yeah. So I think it's very hard to do on visit 1. And I think you need to create a rapport with your patient, but also a rapport with your doctor. If you don't trust the person that you're talking to, or you don't think you can relate to them, then it makes it much more difficult to implement a plan. The first thing I try to do is I try to be as neutral as possible. So I work more than 60 hours a week. I definitely work more than 60 hours a week. I work late hours. I work really early, but I find time to exercise. I find time to cook, and I find time to be with friends and family when I can. And that is one aspect that you don't want to tell people like, oh, I could do this, so you can too, because that doesn't work. Like, a lot of people can lose weight, so you can too. That's not true, because everybody is an individual. Everybody has their biochemical individuality, but everybody has their own, you know, their unique character, their unique personality. So in order to really get them to open up and try to understand, you know, tell me about your stress, I don't really talk to them about it. I ask them to write it down. And they're much more likely to write it down than they are to actually tell me, like, you know, I have erectile dysfunction. Like that, they won't really tell you that right up. But it's like, why are you coming in? Oh, for performance, right? And that's a whole different conversation. So I allow them and I give them different avenues to communicate with me, and I take it step by step. But I also, you have to be really warm and gentle. And I think that's one of the other parts that you could realize who you have to be more aggressive with and who you have to be a little bit more gentle with. And that just takes basically understanding a personality. So those are a few different ways that I help men open up and just basically say, like, look, you don't need to be so tough. But I put it in a perspective of this is what's necessary in order for you to achieve these goals. Like you have come to me, you already know, or you've already decided that you want assistance. So that the question is not like, what do you want? They already know what they need help with. The question is, you know, what are you willing to do to achieve that? And that also depends on exactly what is the goal. So if they're there to lose weight, they're not going to really want to talk about their, you know, their back pain, or they're not really going to want to talk about their hair loss or anything like that, right? They're going to want to talk about their weight loss. And you just have to take it in stride and do each one step by step, because men are very linear. They're very targeted, and they're very, most men are very data or number oriented. So if you can show them in a number of what can be happening, or what is currently happening, then it's easier to convince them. So if I say your fasting insulin is 15, I'd relate to that. But if I tell them your fasting insulin is probably high because you're overweight and you're not exercising, that's more qualitative, and they want more quantitative. So I go very quantitative, see how they respond to that, and then make adjustments there and out.
Yeah, I definitely agree that most men are more data focused. And I think initially I thought that was because I was in Seattle and there are so many software engineers and engineers at Boeing, et cetera. It's a big engineer city. But it seems yep. like that's the case everywhere. And I think also, you know, as men, we have this kind of like singleness of focus. You know, we focus on one thing very well at one time. And I mean, I guess we could argue that comes from like being hunters or, you know, as our ancestors were or whatever. But the point is, you know, if we have one focus, we're able to just attack that focus very well. So when somebody's willing to invest, you know, out of pocket for optimizing their health with a doctor like yourself or myself or our colleagues who do similar things, they're usually all in for the most part. So on the similar lines of stress, I guess we should talk more about what adrenal hormones are, but within that, when cortisol is high, and for the listeners, you know, we're talking about adrenal hormones. So cortisol is one of the main important ones. What are you seeing that is really helpful to help people with lifestyle and natural medicines to lower elevated cortisol levels?
Yeah, I think an even better question before that is, how are we assessing their cortisol levels? And no affiliation, just really like the brand. I'm a huge fan of the Dutch Test. Precision Analytical is a lab, and they have an exceptional team there with Mark and Kerry Jones. It's just, they know exactly what they're doing. So I think the first question is, well, how are you measuring the cortisol? Because that will tell you what needs to be done if it actually is hypercortisolemia. So a serum blood test for cortisol is completely useless. I wouldn't even use it, not even as a screening tool, mostly because it's highly inaccurate. It's bound to cortisol binding protein, which gives you a total and a total cortisol, which doesn't give you the active cortisol. And it gives you no idea as to what the cortisol is throughout the day. So as we know, cortisol has a diurnal pattern. And in order to understand how to treat high cortisol, you need to know what it's doing throughout the day. So you can have a high, let's just say I did a 24-hour cortisol, urinary cortisol, and just collected your cortisol for 24 hours. And I said, okay, over 24 hours, your cortisol was high. Was that in the morning? Was that in the afternoon? Was it at night? Because if it was high in the morning, less concerned than if it were high at nighttime. So that is the first part of the answer, which is not really an answer, sorry. But it's first part of the potential answer to your question, which then is followed up by, is there an issue in the way we partition that cortisol? Are we pushing it to be eliminated via cortisone? Is it a thyroid issue that's contributing to hypercortisolemia? Or is it a lifestyle and sleep thing, which you can measure with, you know, organic acids and melatonin, et cetera? So once you can understand the culprit, then you can understand the treatment. So, but in general, if you're looking at trying to address hypercortisolemia as an overall basis, we're not talking about Cushing's here, because Cushing's syndrome is completely different. It's a strongly pathological hypercortisolemia. What we're talking about, I think, Sam, and correct me if I'm wrong, is, you know, mild to basically non-Cushing's elevated cortisol. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. This question comes from my men's only Facebook group, Live Strong. So for the listeners, somebody asked this question in the group, and I didn't ask them if it was Cushing's, but most likely, and most of the time what we see clinically is exactly what you're talking about. So,
yeah. So then I try to address, well, okay, why is there elevated levels of cortisol? Is it an inability to recover? Now the body is running on increasing its corticosteroids in order to compensate for the sleep deprivation? Or is it so really the other aspect is, what is stress? Stress is the anticipation of a stressor and the perception of a stressor. So in simple terms, if a child is stressed, they are thinking about or seeing a stressor. Now, for children, it's much easier. Oh my God, the big, huge dog is chasing me, right? So that's an anticipation. And then the perception is, holy crap, this dog, which could probably be the size of like a chihuahua, is humongous, right? So it's a perception and the anticipation. And it's up until the point where there's confrontation. Up until the confrontation point, the stressor will continuously be a stressor. So the Chihuahua or the Yorkie is chasing me. It's a huge, huge dog, and I'm going to get pummeled by this huge, huge dog. Then turns into, oh my God, this little cute dog is licking my hand, and it's really not a big deal, right? So most of the stressors in life are really more the former rather than the latter. We can't really perceive the result of the stress stimulus. So in those situations, I see that as an inability to adapt to potential stressors. And why is that? Well, it has a lot to do with our allostatic load, and it has a lot to do with our inability to tolerate certain stimuli. So we have an internal biological threshold as to which beyond that point, we are now exceeding our ability to compensate or adapt. And this is where the word adaptogens come in, because they allow your body to impact the receptor and the function of the enzymes that are involved in mediating the cortisol or stress response. And not just cortisol, but also catecholamines like epinephrine and norepinephrine and adrenaline, right? So when you have those stressors, there's different methods that we can do to address them. Number one is breathing. That's a little bit more acute. Exercise, also a little bit more acute, because you're basically using up a lot of those catecholamines, but also can turn against you, because there are people who just overexercise, right? And this is where we come into social media, and I'm guilty of this. And I see these guys on social media, I'm like, oh my God, these guys are freaking ripped and they're strong. And like, they have these workout videos every day. That means they must be doing the exact same thing that they're saying on their social media every single day. And I think to myself, I know what I know. And I know that that's not completely true. So this is step back, right? So there's that aspect of just exercising, not too much. Sleep obviously is essential. We could even go to a whole conversation about, you know, sleep and how that has impacts your hormones. And then really probably getting to the juicy part, which you and a lot of your listeners are asking, like, what are the things that you can do to help mediate the stress response? And I like Withania somnifera, also called ashwagandha. I particularly like KSM 66, which is a particular form of ashwagandha. I like Rhodiola rosea. That helps, especially in individuals with cognitive impairment from stress. I like Magnolia officinalis. Magnolia is one of the ingredients found in Relora, and we think that it actually can impact CB1 and CB2 receptors, along with GABA receptors, which obviously are anti-anxiolytic and anti-excitatory receptors. So, and actually, Magnolia has hanokiol, which is probably the one of the few adaptogens that we know can cross a blood-brain barrier. So those are probably my big three in terms of herbs that can help. And then obviously, theanine and threonate are two huge tools that we can use to help improve the stress response, because they actually can impact our glutamate receptors, which are excitatory. And, you know, I could get really deep into the science of it, but essentially it's, they helped adapt the, reduce the excitatory response of what can typically be caused by the anticipation and the perception of stress.
Excellent overview. Yeah, that was definitely good. I like the, I really like ashwagandha. I'm a huge fan of ashwagandha. And there's, for those listening, there's a lot of research on ashwagandha. And I interviewed Kerry Bone, and everyone should go listen to that interview. But one of the things he mentioned that is stuck in my mind is that 5 grams has to be obviously a high quality source, like you mentioned, of ashwagandha a day can increase strength. And there's even been research in mountaineers that 1 gram improved a lot of the things that mountaineers suffer with at high altitude. So overall,
interesting. So endurance. Like altitude sickness?
Yeah, like endurance and decrease altitude sickness and things like that. I guess I would have to pull the study to look at all the different parameters. Cool. But amazing that 1 gram versus at regular altitude, 5 grams is working more on the strength and endurance. So everybody should listen to that part of what Ralph just said again, maybe do a good overview of that for the audience.
That was 5 grams of raw withania? It's hard to get 5 grams of ashwagandha in a capsule. That's probably liquid. 10, 12 capsules. Oh, you could do liquid.
Yeah. So with MediHerb, they have a 1-to-1 and a 2-to-1 liquid extract. And they do a cold, they call it a cold percolation. And
interesting.
These large percolation units that are like these giant pipes. And for days, they're percolating through there. So if you think about like a coffee percolation, it's a hot percolation. So that's why they call it cold. And it's a proprietary mechanism. They don't obviously share much more than that. But they have, I think in Australia, they only sell the 2-to-1. I could be wrong about that. And then they have the 1-to-1 liquid extract, similar to a tincture. But for the listener, a tincture is usually a 1-to-5. Ratio, and that's usually what you can make at home, even with the
which is for your listeners more dilute.
Yes, than,
right.
Yeah.
So, like a 1-to-1 would be a lot. Which is basically a 1-to-1 ratio of herb to liquid, whereas a 1-to-5 is a 1-to-5 ratio of herb to liquid or extract to liquid or whatever you want to call it.
Exactly. So I usually use MediHerb liquids. I did a, I guess it's an N of one case study, if you will.
And which counts in my book.
Which is means nothing. Again, like what Ralph said, which means nothing to the listener. But since I'm not able to do like massive studies, I have more data than one. But this one person was traveling for work to India, to London, from Seattle to Chicago, other time zones in the US for work. Basically every 2 months. So going back to what you're talking about, cortisol and all that stuff, and we know from shift workers that all this kind of travel just wrecks all the hormones eventually. So they had low testosterone around, I can't legally say their age, but let's say they're around age 40-ish, male, obviously. And he was doing a bunch of different liquid extracts, ashwagandha, Korean ginseng and Siberian ginseng, and not taking him with him on his trip. So it wasn't the best example, but he would be gone for a couple of weeks and then come back and start taking them again. He's weight training, smoker, not probably eating as well as he could, but eating okay. One of the issues was sleep too. So we can get maybe into sleep next when we talk about testosterone. And his testosterone increased less than 60 points for total testosterone. And there was a marginal, from my memory, a marginal increase in free T. And so I haven't, there's been a few scenarios where I've seen lifestyle and diet increase it up to 200 or even higher, like in sleep apnea, when they get on a CPAP machine, increase it like 600 points for total T in 4 months. But this was a 4 month study or therapeutic trial, if you will. And we got it up 60. So that's why, you know, we can talk about lifestyle in a minute around testosterone. You got to do the lifestyle stuff, you know, no matter what medicines you're taking. If you're doing low dose testosterone, bioidenticals, hormones, creams, injections, whatever, you got to do the lifestyle stuff. And then that goes with the cortisol too. If you're just going to like drink down ashwagandha every morning and sleep 5 hours every night, you know, you might get, you'll probably get some symptomatic relief, but you're still going to have some stuff going on. Yeah. So do your research, read about those herbs, and find the good sources. Carrie Bone has books you can buy online or on Amazon, whatever. I don't care where you get it as long as it's what it is. But don't buy herbs on Amazon. They're usually counterfeit. So,
yeah.
Yeah, so that's it. I like your, I agree with you. Dutch testing is what I use in my clinic with patients. And I really appreciate your overview about blood cortisol versus urine and free cortisol pattern throughout the day. I'm sure you are too, educating patients why they need to do a Dutch test. So it's very important to have that information for overall health. As we move forward, I'd love to get into thyroid versus testosterone, their interrelations. We could probably do a whole hour just on this topic, but there's with men, there seems to be more and more low thyroid than there used to be. And even Hashimoto's I've found more often with men. Used to be that in the textbook, you would read Hashimoto's thyroiditis, autoimmune disease of the thyroid causing, you know, low thyroid function, destruction of thyroid gland eventually is mostly found in women statistically. But we're seeing it clinically. I've been talking to other colleagues too in the greater Western Washington area, and they say the same thing. And that relationship of hypothyroidism to testosterone, because somebody could go, for example, for the listener, you could go to a low T clinic. They could not test your thyroid hormones whatsoever and just test testosterone and then say, oh, you need testosterone. But if we don't know what's going on with your adrenals and your thyroid, then you could be undertreated or miss a major diagnosis like autoimmune disease or hypothyroidism. So maybe we can start with, I'll back it up for you to make it more bite-sized for everybody. What is hypothyroidism? What are some of the signs and symptoms of hypothyroidism, and how can that mimic low testosterone?
Oh man. So you only gave me about an hour to talk with you about this, Sam.
Yeah, I know. We can give them the bite-sized chunk.
Yeah. So, geez. Okay. So essentially hypothyroidism, it can be measured by a reduction or an elevated TSH along with a low serum free T4 level. And most physicians would just use a TSH, and it gets really confusing for a lot of people because they're like, oh, well, my TSH is high, so my thyroid is high, therefore I'm normal. And actually it's the opposite. And it's because most endocrine systems in the body are negative feedback. So essentially what happens is that your brain sees less thyroid hormone, then it releases more thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH, which then tells your thyroid to make more thyroid hormone, right? It's like not enough gas in the car. Ding, the low gas meter goes off, add more gas to the car, right? And that cycle keeps on going. That's a negative feedback method. So that's what happens with hypothyroidism. And symptoms in men, although this is less common in men, but the statistics suggest that the prevalence is increasing, and about 1 in 1,000 men will have hypothyroidism. And in women, it's a little bit more common, with about 3 to 4 in 1,000 women having hypothyroidism or being diagnosed. I bet you I find it a lot more in most men. And, you know, one of my best friends, he's a DO, and he's finishing up his residency, and I love him to death, but we just can't agree on hypothyroidism. He's just like, no, the TSH is 4.8. It's totally fine. And I said, no, it's not. We need to fight, right? But I love him so much. He was my roommate at NYU, and I'm just like, let's just grab a drink and let's just hang out. Nonetheless, so a TSH in my book above 2.5 warrants further workup and to assess if you have hypothyroidism. And then I look into free T4 and I look into free T3. If those numbers are low and the TSH is high, then it tells me that your TSH, that you potentially can be hypothyroid. But what does that look like in men? It looks a little bit different in men than in women. And the only reason, I think, is because women are a little bit more, pay more attention to the things than men do. So most men will have dry skin. Women will be like, oh my God, my skin is super dry. And men will be like, oh, just wear, use some lotion. A lot of women will lose hair, or they'll notice frequent hair loss or hair weakness where it's breaking often. Men will be like, oh, I really haven't noticed anything going on. I'm getting older, right? Brittle nails. Women will notice that because they let their nails grow out and they get manicures, and the stylist at the manicure place will tell them, oh, well, your nails are getting weak. And men are just like, oh, well, my nails, I just keep on cutting them. I really can't tell. But then there's other aspects of like fatigue and low motivation. And then actually, which is misconceived by most practitioners, is slow bowel movements or slow bowel function. So essentially your thyroid hormone has an impact on the motility of your digestive tract. So if you have an increased gastric emptying time. That means if the food sits in your gut much longer, that can be an indication of low thyroid function, which presents as constipation. Now, I think everybody should be having a bowel movement every single day. If they're eating every single day, most physicians think if you go 4 days without having a bowel movement, you should be fine. Well, that's just bullshit. Okay. So excuse my French, Sam.
I agree with you. You can swear on my podcast. Yeah.
All right, great. I'm from New York. I don't know if your listeners are able to notice yet. Yeah. So I've kept it a little bit PG, but I have the green light. Okay. So you gave me the green light, Sam. So, but I'll behave. Okay. So then you look at those symptoms, but then other symptoms could be, which can be masked with low testosterone, is fatigue, low libido, and low drive, right? So could the ability or the inability of a man to have an erection not necessarily be due to their low testosterone, but be to their low thyroid because they just don't have enough energy, they really feel worn out and fatigued, and they just don't feel like pursuing, right? Because they just want to rest. And that is probably one of the reasons why they just can't be stimulated because they're just not, they don't have the energy to do so. So that's where testosterone and thyroid kind of overlap a little bit, but you need thyroid hormone in order for your testosterone receptors to work properly. So the androgen receptor requires T3, which is the active thyroid hormone. And without that, in hypothyroidism, those androgen receptors become sluggish. And if those receptors become sluggish, then they're not going to respond as robustly to the testosterone or the other androgens. And then the transcription and translation of DNA that occurs when your hormones bind to the DNA, bind to the receptor, won't occur. And that creates a trickle-down effect where you experience symptoms of both. So oftentimes, if I have a man who has low testosterone and low thyroid, I treat the low thyroid first.
Excellent overview. Yeah. I love that tidbit about the androgen receptor and T3, active thyroid hormone, helping the androgen receptor. Very important. Seems like, I started one of my first jobs out of naturopathic medical school was working in a low T clinic. And one of the frustrations I had there is they didn't test thyroid as much as I thought they should. And we had machines. They were $30,000 machines. They were the test of the testosterone and PSA. Total testosterone, and then we'd show the patient, hey, your PSA is not elevated, blah, blah, blah. You can, you know, a lot of problems with that. But overall, you know, these low T clinics are, in my opinion, overprescribing. I used to run two of them, so I can speak to that, arguing with owners and not wanting to prescribe testosterone in a lot of cases. When men had, you know, a 700 total testosterone in their initial visit. So with that said, I do prescribe low-dose testosterone to some men who need it over age, you know, 40-ish. So I'm curious, what are your thoughts on testosterone replacement therapy? We're talking about, you know, bioidenticals and prescriptions and stuff like that. And what have you seen in the research?
Yeah, I've probably read mostly all of the major studies on testosterone, and I read anything new that comes out. I get alerts on anything new that comes out on a daily basis. And I think that there's a big misconception on how testosterone should be used properly. In short, I'm not a fan of the gels. I'm not a fan of the patches. I think the best way to supplement testosterone, first and foremost, is to achieve adequate amounts of sleep and a low glycemic, low carbohydrate diet, and also weight training, but not overtraining. So aside from those interventions, which I consider those to be interventions, the other intervention would be injections. And then there's also pellets, which have an advantage and they're a little bit more tolerable, but less controllable. And I think low-dose testosterone supplementation, exogenous, is completely safe. There's very, very little research, if any, suggesting it does pose any risk. And the upside is tremendously high. with the caveat of you need to make sure that you are seeing somebody who knows exactly what that hormone is doing in the body, how to measure it, how to monitor it, and how to assess for adverse effects from it. So as you mentioned, PSA is something that you want to test, which absolutely you should. But it's not the only thing. You want to also check your free PSA, and you need to assess for family history. Do they have a family history of prostate cancer? Why am I bringing this up? Well, I don't know if you've probably heard on other podcasts that I was on or even other conversations that we've had. I do not see any literature suggesting that elevated testosterone levels cause or contribute to prostate cancer. In fact, there's a lot of literature suggesting the opposite. And I believe that research because it's replicated frequently and it's excellent design studies. So, but why do you have to do that? Well, because if somebody actually has prostate cancer, then it's already in the phase of malignancy. It's already in the phase of growth and potentially could be metastasizing. And steroids, testosterone is an anabolic steroid, but insulin is also an anabolic steroid. Right. So the same way that testosterone can cause increases in prostate cancer, insulin can do the exact same thing, not because testosterone is bad, it's just because it's causing it to grow and it's causing it to get bigger. And the prostate is a testosterone sensitive organ. So actually, so is the penis. But, you know, penile cancer is very, very rare. So it's not usually an issue. But insulin is an anabolic hormone, and insulin can easily, as much as testosterone, increase the risk of prostate cancer because it causes growth. So, but you have to make sure that somebody doesn't have prostate cancer while you begin it with them because you just don't want to put fuel on the fire. So that's what a few things that your listeners should definitely be paying attention to, but also you have to make sure your practitioner understands, you know, what are the biomechanics and the biophysiology of the pharmacodynamics of testosterone. You know, what does it get converted to? Does it get converted to DHT? Is it getting converted to estradiol? Does it get converted to estrone? Are those DHT metabolites getting converted into the 3-alpha and 3-beta metabolites of DHT, right? What impacts are those having on your estrogen receptors? So there's such a profound conversation that can be had on this. And I think in short, starting at a low dose of testosterone, typically cypionate, which is pretty safe. We have studies. The largest study that I recall was approximately 8 years. That there might be one a little bit longer than that, but this one was a large study over 8 years, and they found that I think maybe one or two people in that population experienced prostate cancer while actually on it. I think it was almost, 75 to 100 men. So it's not a huge study, but it was over a long period of time. And there wasn't a high risk of prostate cancer. They all screened them, but they had a lot of other benefits. They increased their lipids. They increased their lipid regulation. So their cholesterol actually improved. Their bone mineral density improved. They improved their body composition. So their health span increased with the supplementation of testosterone replacement therapy. But I don't think it's for everybody. I don't think everybody needs it. But I don't see any harm in utilizing it as a therapy if and when appropriate.
I agree 100%. Yeah, definitely. And on a similar vein, let's say somebody is younger and they may want to have children. Let's say they're 30 or 28, somewhere around there. What are your thoughts on using HCG and Clomid for younger men with low testosterone levels?
Yeah, I think there's two issues with this, is that we have more data on testosterone than we do on Clomid. Clomid technically is used off-label and used as a hormone replacement therapy for men. It's really a fertility drug. It's called a SERM, selective estrogen receptor modulator. And what it does, it blocks estrogen receptors in the brain, which then stimulate the release of luteinizing hormone, which then tells the body to make more testosterone. So that is a little bit more quote unquote natural because it's not exogenous testosterone, but it's still impacting your hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis. In younger men, it's much safer to use HCG and Clomid because it doesn't increase the risk of infertility or decrease sperm count and volume like testosterone replacement therapy would, exogenous testosterone. Because what testosterone will do, and HCG can do this too if you get too high of a dose, is it will suppress FSH and LH. And that basically you need LH and FSH in order to make sperm, healthy sperm and well-developed sperm. So in younger men who have low testosterone, I'm not opposed to Clomid, I'm not opposed to HCG, but it's usually not my first option because you're 20 something years old, 30 something years old, there should be another reason why this is occurring. So then we have to rule out, you know, what are the other causes? Is there a varicose heel? Was there cryptorchidism, which is basically an undescended testicle, either now or in childhood? Was there trauma to the testicle? Is it not producing enough testosterone? Are there heavy metals that can be contributing to this? Perhaps there's a sleep deprivation that the body's unable to recover, and that's what we call secondary hypogonadism, where your brain's not making the hormones necessary. There's so many different variables that go into it that makes me wonder, you know, do we really need to be treating this as aggressively in such a young individual? And that's where I would say, probably not. Let's try to identify why this is happening, identify the cause, and then we can treat. But Clomid and HCG, they can have, in some individuals, they can reset an individual's nadir testosterone levels. So sometimes it'll wake up the pituitary and say, all right, well, time to start moving, and then it puts it into a new rhythm. I have no research to suggest that. I have no literature to support that. That's my clinical impression. But I've seen it enough times to know that it's low risk and high benefit.
Spectacular. Yeah, I usually like to wait as long as possible to do HCG and Clomid, and I've seen mixed results clinically with them with younger men. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And then Clomid can have a pretty long half-life for people, so if you come off of Clomid, that can have some repercussions. Mm-hmm. With herbs and supplements, what have you seen actually help men under age 40, mostly healthy, actually improve testosterone levels and resolve the symptoms of low testosterone, low libido, low motivation, increase lean muscle mass with weightlifting and stuff like that?
Right. I think without any of the lifestyle interventions, it's very hard for these supplements to have a profound impact, mostly because, even some drugs, aside from obviously testosterone, have difficulty in being effective if the underlying machinery is not working. So there are certain supplements that I find to be helpful and supportive, usually as a conglomerate of therapeutics, and ashwagandha is one. DHEA is another supplement that can work very well, although you really need to assess your DHEAS levels. There is some literature suggesting that nettle root, actually a study came out today that one of the constituents in nettle root does not decrease SHBG levels, but it can bind to SHBG. And for your listeners, SHBG is sex hormone binding globulin, and it's basically the protein that makes your testosterone less available. So the higher the SHBG, the less free testosterone that you have. And so when you have less SHBG, you can have more free testosterone, and that can have a beneficial impact on your free testosterone levels. So nettle root can be helpful. I mentioned ashwagandha. DHEA can be helpful. Zinc supplementation. There are some indications that zinc deficiency can have an impact on testosterone levels. I don't find salt palmetto to work very well. A lot of practitioners think that because it inhibits 5-alpha reductase that it has an impact on increasing testosterone levels. That's not true. It very weakly inhibits 5-alpha reductase. In fact, some pharmaceuticals like finasteride and dutasteride, which are pharmaceutical 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, even those have difficulty increasing testosterone levels. So I wouldn't go that route. And then there is some literature suggesting Tonkat Ali, Urocomia longifolia, Macuna perens, which is dopamine, that typically works if prolactin levels are higher. It really is a selective, assault that you need to use, but together it can be quite effective, assuming you're addressing the right cause.
Yeah, I definitely agree on the lifestyle stuff. And that seems the hardest stuff for men to change. And I mean, anybody to change, really, you know, get enough sleep, get enough exercise, eat the right things, don't eat the other things that are going to decrease hormones or cause potentiate metabolic syndrome and high cholesterol or cholesterolemia. So we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I wanted to get into this discussion about what health span is, what the definition of health span is that people should know about, and what are some key things in lifestyle that people can do to live healthier, longer lives.
Got it. So the lifestyle things that we can do to improve our health span, right? Because there's lifespan and then there's health span. I'm interested in living longer, but not at the expense of living sicker. So I think it's very important to differentiate between the two. I want to live as long as I can, as young as I can, which basically means I don't want to really live a day longer of a life that I would not want to live. I don't have kids, but I want to play with them and hang out with them as long as I can. But not even just play with them. I want to be able to talk with them. I want to be able to share my life with them, my experiences, and just have a conversation. My father passed away with Lewy body dementia, and I wish that upon nobody. I don't want anybody to have to experience what it's like to actually, you know, for lack of better terms, lose your mind. So the thing that we can do today is that we really have to prevent the things that kill us, prevent the things that cause you to die. And we know that heart disease is one of them. You know, cancer is another. Alzheimer's and dementia. Those are the things that kill people. So what can we do today to prevent those things? And it's not a supplement. Although there are supplements that help, but it's not a supplement. It's making sure you keep your insulin levels low throughout your lifespan, right? So not necessarily being keto or low carb forever, but making sure that you put yourself in an environment where your body can utilize fuel and partition fuel properly. So weight training, right? How do you make sure that you use your fuel as energy? You lift weights. And people think like, oh, well, I lift weights and that means that I'm going to, you know, burn fat during my actual workout. No, we're talking about the post-exercise energy expenditure. Right. And that's what we really need to pay attention to, because more muscle mass means an increase in metabolism, which then allows you to utilize your sugar better. So weight training is number one, but not to dismiss cardiovascular training, because you do need to make sure that your mitochondria are functioning well, and cardiovascular training is one of the main tools that we can use for that, but also weight training. Secondly, you want to make sure that you sleep at least seven to 7.5 hours per night. And that's just because autophagy occurs most of the time when you're sleeping. And we need to make sure that the cells that need to be recycled, destroyed, and reused are doing exactly that. So that's super important. And then, making sure you're putting the right things in your body. So I think there's so much controversy of, you know, with these vegan, keto. I feel like 2019 was, you know, like just put like a keto guy and a vegan in a boxing ring and like see who wins, right? It's like, I don't know, like Joe Rogan, who is pretty much paleo, you know, high meat type of diet, and like, I don't know, like somebody from like Game Changers or What the Health, and like see who wins. I feel like that was 2019, which is so frustrating to me, because yes, in essence, like, I don't care if you just eat plants, and I don't care if you just eat animal sources of food. Just want to make sure you're not eating crap. I want to make sure you're eating actual food. Now there are caveats. Like you can't have just soy, or tofu. You can't have just bacon, right? But I'm pretty much confident that if anybody follows either a paleo diet or a vegetarian diet, they're likely, if under the proper guidance, and I usually promote, you know, integrative, naturopathic, functional, holistic practitioners, because they typically have the proper training in nutrition and lifestyle medicine to implement those changes. I think those diets can be healthy, especially compared to the standard American. And that's typically the approach that I would take with most people is those are the three pillars that I think are necessary. But then lastly, social. Make sure you're with other people, because if you're a hermit and you're stuck in your room all day, you're not going to be happy. And that has a huge impact on your lifestyle and your sense of well-being.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, there's a lot of research about the blue zones and health and everything. And yeah, mm-hmm. 2019 was definitely the year of let's fight about things that, you know, most people are still eating in middle America. You know, I go to Montana, small town Montana. Most people don't know how to just eat regular food, or they're scared of regular food because, you know, mom and grandma overcooked the vegetables, or they grew up eating canned beans that looked gray or something or whatever, you know, so they have weird things. I had a friend in high school who both his parents were MDs from Kansas. And he said, he told everybody he was allergic to broccoli because he hated broccoli. So it's like stuff like that just stays with us. And then we're like, well, I hate broccoli and I'm allergic to it. And then we start believing it, and it just gets to be a big problem. But mm-hmm. yeah, there's, you know, I think the future of medicine, and this could be a whole other podcast interview, would be looking at like genetics, epigenetics, hormones, all the stuff we talked about, what supplements are actually needed based on somebody's genetics and family medical history and their life and lifestyle. And then all the lifestyle stuff, like you're talking about sleep. I mean, sleep is huge. It's number one. It's always been at the top of my list of my lifestyle handout guide when we used to do paper handouts back in the day. But there was one quick thing that you shared with me before we started hitting record here about the fish oil study that just came out in the last 4 months about something about the amount of fish oil decreasing MIs. Let's just share that with everybody so they can kind of have a wraparound about how fish oils are actually healthy.
Yeah, so there was a recent study that came out called the REDUCE-IT trial. There was an additional study which came out, which the name is slipping me right now. And you could put it in your show notes after. I can't remember the name of it right now, but one study used 1,000 milligrams of EPA DHA and another one used 4,000 milligrams of EPA. And they found that actually the studies that the REDUCE-IT trial showed that EPA aside from reducing triglycerides, which alone can be a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, actually can reduce cardiovascular risk. So there's things that in our lifestyle that are something that we just can't supplement with. Unfortunately, we just can't eat that much salmon. We can't eat that much sardines or mackerel you just can't consume all of that. So I think supplementing with a fish oil is number one, necessary for most individuals. And unfortunately, plant-based omega-3 fatty acids in the form of ALA are insufficient. They're incapable of being converted to EPA and DHA in insufficient amounts. So you could even consume up to 10 grams of flax or chia or hemp, and you will have a very difficult time increasing your the saturation of omega-3s in your red blood cells. So I think that's really important for men, just of course, because cardiovascular disease is one of the major killers in men. And if we're really going to be diligent and try to optimize, then let's do everything that we can, which kind of falls into the conversation of like vegan versus paleo or keto or whatever it is. And that's probably one of my biggest aspects of combating a vegan diet or a vegetarian, unless it's pesco vegetarian, is you completely miss the supplementation of omega-3 fatty acids, EPA and DHA, which you just can't get from plants. So that is a major aspect that I think is super important for men just moving forward in their daily life plan.
Well said. Yeah, everybody take your fish oils, make sure they're high quality, get them from a practitioner, don't buy them on Amazon. They have a whole issue with counterfeiting. So take your fish oils. I actually just had this conversation with a patient this week about, hey, you're not going to be able to eat enough fish. So I really appreciate you sharing that with everybody. Well, thank you so much for your time. I know you got to get on with a client. Everybody should follow Dr. Ralph Esposito on Instagram if you're not already. And you can find him there at dr.ralphesposito, last name spelled E-S-P-O-S-I-T-O, and Dr. Ralph Esposito on Twitter. So I, again, thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to part two, maybe in 2020 sometime. Happy holidays. All my best to you. And until next time, thank you.
Now here's for my mandatory disclaimer. This is a medical information podcast and is only for general information purposes. It does not substitute or constitute the practice of medicine or any medical practices, including the giving of medical advice to any individual. And please observe that no doctor-patient relationship has been formed here. This medical podcast offers health, hormone, fitness, and nutrition information and is designed for educational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitution for, nor does it replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, you should always consult with a physician or other healthcare professional. Do not disregard, avoid, or delay obtaining medical or health-related advice and appropriate treatment from your healthcare professional. Users should seek the care of their physician or healthcare professional for any such conditions. The use of any information provided on this podcast is solely at your own risk. The contents and topics of this podcast have not been evaluated by the FDA nor approved by any other government or official body. The topics and content covered is not intended to diagnose, cure, or prevent any disease or disorder of any kind. Developments in medical research may impact the health, fitness, and nutritional advice that appears here on the podcast in the future episodes. No assurance can be given that the advice contained in this podcast will always include the most recent findings or developments in medicine with respect to the particular material covered. If you are in the United States and think you are having a medical or health emergency, call your healthcare professional or 911 immediately. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing your feedback and looking forward to have you on future podcasts. Thank you.